The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello and welcome to our New Year podcast. In this show, we'll be chatting about what's in store for 2011, what's to look forward to and what's to fear. And which camp does this fall into?
You made crusty bread rolls filled with chunks of brie and minced garlic drizzled with olive oil and baked them until the brie was bubbly and we ate them lovingly, our legs coiled together under the table.
And we'll reveal the identity of our singing sonneteer later. Meanwhile, in the studio with me are podcast regulars Sarah Crown and Richard Lee, and our indefatigable, although she says she's rather fatigable at the moment, and well-informed undoubtedly conscript from the bookseller Benedicta Page. Now, Ben, there's one issue that's been affecting the whole industry this year and is going to intensify next year, and that's the steady progress of digital books, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I remember us talking about this at exactly this time last year and looking forward, and you asking me perhaps with an edge of scepticism whether this was the year everyone was going to start really using ebooks, reading ebooks. And it certainly made a massive leap over 2010 with the launch of the iPad, Amazon's new Kindle. Everybody's talking about it. Of course, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that it's still an absolutely tiny part.
It's 10% in the US.
In the US, it's grown to about 10%. In the UK, it depends who you ask. It's still hard to get reliable figures, but it's probably around 2%. So maybe as much as 4%, but certainly no more than that. So it's still a very, very tiny part of the market. But we are obviously expecting to follow the pattern that the States have shown, which will be of massive growth.
So what's the effect been on publishing so far? Not much.
No, in fact, it's had a massive effect on publishing, but it's very much behind the scenes. It's in the term of everybody really re-engineering the business and creating, if you like, the infrastructure for how publishing is going to develop in the digital age. So there've been intense, heated discussions behind the scenes, certainly as publishers start to work out their new commercial relationships with, you know, obviously Apple, Google, Amazon. These have been the subject of very, as I say, quite heated discussions and indeed a shift in commercial patterns as publishers shift from a wholesale model to the agency model with their ebooks, where they get to keep some control over the price of the ebooks.
And we've got a couple of agents who've begun to muscle in, haven't we? The Wiley agency in the States.
Well, yes, that's quite an interesting one. They launched Odyssey Editions, effectively bypassing the publisher and producing their authors' ebooks themselves. But I must say that hasn't really taken off as a concept yet, and I think the role of the publisher is still very, very central and likely to be so for the foreseeable future. Although people are obviously considering other alternatives.
Now, I went to a rather scary publishing conference with a publisher which shall remain nameless, where the MD was telling the troops that there would be no more boozy lunches with booksellers because booksellers are a thing of the past. Is that true?
Really? That's astonishing. No, it's not a thing of the past. And what's been very interesting in the last year or so is to see how bookselling, in a sense, has sort of found new directions in the age of the big online retailers. So there's been really strong performance from independent booksellers, people like Foyles, Daunts, other, you know, really good small independents have found ways of exploiting their own special way of selling books, really knowing their customers, having very personal service, holding events. And that's proved very successful. And, you know, Waterstones is also taking a much more local approach to its book selling as well, because people really do want that kind of book selling as well as, you know, the big cheap book selling that happens online.
Okay, so let's look a little bit about where we are now and where we've come from this year. Richard, it started quite badly the year, didn't it?
Well, I mean, looking back to the beginning of 2010, it was a rather depressing first half of the year. There was a recession with the collapse of the banking system. Then we had an election and the disaster of the World Cup for everyone to think about. So publishing was really very much on the back burner.
And then Bennett began to look up in the second half of the year.
Yes, what really swung it, I think, what changed the mood was the big political books, Peter Mandelson's book, Tony Blair's book, suddenly all over the headlines. Suddenly the media was dominated by books again, which which really changed the mood of the industry, I think, actually. And then when the Frankfurt Book Fair came in October, there was just a lot more feeling of optimism, some big buys, just a
people
general
feeling.
People
getting their chequebooks out again.
Yes,
enough
they
austerity.
Were. Yes, I think people just got tired and bored of austerity. You know, editors are naturally acquisitive animals, and I think there's only so long they can rein their instincts in for.
So let's look at what we've got coming up in the new year, which actually probably would all have been bought in the Frankfurt of the previous year. Sarah, lots and lots of fiction.
Yes, it looks like it's going to be an absolutely brilliant year for fiction, I think. We've got new novels coming from the likes of Edward St. Aubyn, Alan Hollinghurst, Neil Jordan and Enright Ali Smith, to name just a few of the people who are publishing this year.
I'm going to ask each of you to talk about a couple of books that you're particularly keen on. Sarah, should we start with you?
Yeah, sure. Well, the Edward St. Aubyn that I mentioned, this is the final book in his Melrose Family saga. You might remember that Mother's Milk was shortlisted for the Booker a few years back. And I've been reading these books all the way through, and I think they're absolutely fantastic, completely gripping, fairly bleak, grim reading, but beautifully written. He's an amazing prose stylist, so I'm really looking forward to his novel. And then also this year, probably for me, the one that I'm most excited about is Roddy Doyle's new novel,
Bullfighting. Oh, yeah, you fell for him a bit, didn't you?
I really did, yeah. I completely hook, line and sinker. The last novel that he brought out, which was the last in the Henry Smart trilogy, didn't get very good reviews. People weren't super keen on it, but he was in here to talk about it. And he's just such an incredible presence on stage. I was absolutely swept away. And then I went and read Women Who Walk Into Doors, which I hadn't read before, and thought, you know, this is just incredible stuff. So I'm really looking forward to
reading.
So it's
a sort of new beginning for Roddy Doyle.
And also it has that thing of it's a book, although we're talking about what's coming up, it's a book that's looking back on the past. He's an Irish writer. Ireland's obviously been through a hell of a time over the last couple of years. And this is a book about the recession to an extent, and men facing up to the state that the country's left them in. So it should be really interesting, I think.
Mm-hmm. Richard, how about you?
Yeah, well, I'm always interested in anything that Harry Kunzru's got coming, and he's got Gods Without Men coming out in August, which is apparently a return to the bigger canvas of his earlier work. But it'd be interesting to see what he does with the kind of formal control that he had with his last My Revolutions, to see how that pans out on a bigger stage. And also, a little earlier than that in the year, in April, we've got a David Foster Wallace book, which was left unfinished when he killed himself 2 years ago, and has been assembled from his manuscripts by his long-time editor. It's set almost entirely in a tax office and is trying to reclaim the lives of people performing what seems to be even the most monotonous job. But it'd be fascinating to see not only the finished project, but also to hear about how the process of putting it together went about.
He's a real writer's writer, isn't he? It always seems to me there's more excitement among writers than among a mass readership for his work. Is that true or is that unfair, do you think?
I think there's a constituency that's looking forward to anything, that any scraps that are still left to be found. I mean, I think he's kind of just an amazing voice.
OK, Ben? How about you?
Well, my eye was very much caught by a debut that's coming out in March. It's called Pigeon English by Stephen Kelman. And it's one of the few debuts in the current climate that have really been fought over by publishers. And it's just a wonderful novel, really very touching, I think. It's narrated by an 11-year-old boy who has recently come over to England from Ghana, and he's living on a rather unprepossessing and pigeon-crowded council estate. And his voice is just utterly compelling. It's very natural, very real. It's very much an 11-year-old boy. And the story has some resonances of the Damilola Taylor story. There is a fatal stabbing on the estate, and this young boy takes it upon himself to investigate.
And when is this out?
It's out in March.
That's out in March. Mm. And I actually did a little bit of a ring round of our regular critics, and one of them was Catherine Taylor, who's our first novel reviewer, and she says she's also very taken with Hannah Pittard's The Fates Will Find Their Way, which is published by Heinemann, and it's a story about a girl's disappearance in small town America. Richard, first novels. I mean, the trouble with them, they're an awful lot of them, aren't there? But the trouble is we don't know what they are until they've hit us. So it just happens that Ben's read that and Catherine's read Pittard.
The most exciting thing is to find somebody new, to find something that we've never seen before. I mean, I've just seen the first story. The Faber's got a story cycle coming from the actor James Franco about listless teens in America, which sounds like it might be in similar sort of territory. The first chapter, which I thought was very, very, very good. Bleak stuff, but very good. And there's a couple more. There's Mirza Wahid has written a book called The Collaborator, which is due out in February. Which is a novel of the conflict in Kashmir. I remember when Basharat Peer's Curfewed Night was longlisted for the first book award. I remember thinking there was probably a novel in there somewhere. Well, it could be this will be it, or one of them. And looking a little bit further ahead, there's Dulkey. You've got a book from Asaf Shur called Moti. He's writing in Hebrew, coming out in May, which is a man without ties who takes the rap for a traffic accident. Sounds fascinating. Again, no idea what it's going to be like till we see it, but that's the excitement of it.
Oh, dear Sarah. Does it fill your heart with dread, all these first novels winging their way towards us? Of course, we spend a large part of our year reading them, don't we?
Yes, we do, which is a pleasure, of course, most of the time.
But we've just finished, we have to say, we've only just wrapped up the last
one.
Well,
exactly, yeah, that's true. But what I was thinking about it, Ben, I don't know whether you think this is true or not, but it seems to me that the number of first novels might possibly speak to the health of the publishing industry.
Well, that's quite a debatable point, I think. Certainly, there seem to be more first novels. I mean, the first half of the year, the first part of the year particularly, is always strong on first novels. It's a traditional time to bring them out. But it seems that there are more than ever this year. And it's hard to know what the reasoning is behind it. It could be two things. Either it could be, as you say, the health of the industry, that people are feeling that they can invest in new writers and can be successful in bringing them out into the market. Or there is the possibility that, you know, advances really have fallen very low indeed over recent months because it's been such tough times.
So it's just cheaper to buy up a lot of new people.
Well, that could be it, yeah.
And you give them one shot and then they're out, really, isn't it? And that's the sad side of it.
Who knows? One hopes that isn't the case. And there are a lot of committed editors who do still believe in building authors. And obviously, if you haven't invested a massive amount in an author before you publish them, there's less riding on them getting it absolutely right first time. So, you know, the dynamics are quite complex here.
Non-fiction, always hugely diverse, and we are going to take potluck. We're going to start with politics. Obviously, 2010 election year has been a big political year. Are there lots of political books to look forward to next year, Ben?
It is interesting. About 6 months ago, well, before the election, everything was very quiet on the political publishing front. There didn't seem an enormous amount of stuff to say or an enormous amount of enthusiasm about reading it. But all that has changed, obviously, with these incredibly successful political memoirs and also just a sense that there's so much going on politically now in this new landscape of the coalition.
That Clegg is going to have his first biography, I notice, in the summer.
That's
from
right.
Biteback. Interesting publisher. That's a new publisher this year.
That's right. It's been set up by Ian Dale, who's pretty well known as a blogger, Ian Dale's Diary, and he also broadcasts. But he's actually got a background as a political bookseller and publisher. And they're doing a lot of quite swift turnaround titles where they come up with something very topical and bring it out quite quickly. And they've got a biography of Nick Clegg coming out, as you say, in the summer from Chris Bowers, who has also done a biography of Roger Federer.
Federer. He's a Lib Dem. He's a councillor, I think, or something. So he's obviously got the inside track, but it's rather weird that his last one was tennis. Richard, there's still quite a bit of mopping up, isn't there, the last administration?
Yeah,
we haven't
seen the end of New Labour yet. We've got Alastair Campbell's Diaries, volumes 7 and 8, or I can't remember what, in January. We've got.
I think you'll find it's 2 and 3.
There
Richard.
You go.
Come on, behave.
In which case,
it's only got to 1997 so far. It's a bit depressing, isn't it?
Volume 17 and 24 coming in January. Volume 2, Power and the People, about the early years of power, 1997 to 99. Volume 3 due in July, Power and Responsibility. There you go. There's a big word for New Labour, 1999 to 2001.
And there's a bigger picture, Sarah, isn't there? There are bigger thinkers. If you're fed up of Westminster politics and don't think it's politics anyway, which increasingly we don't.
Yes,
what else
not.
Is there to look forward to?
It's all showmanship at the minute. In terms of the bigger picture, we have The Origins of Political Order coming out from Francis Fukuyama, which is published by Profile.
He, of course, prophesied the end of history.
Yes.
He seems to have been wrong.
Well, luckily for him, as he's now bringing out a new book. This is the history, you know, the whole sweep from pre-human times right the way through to the French Revolution. And then moving from the past into the future, we have Making the Future from Noam Chomsky, and that's coming out in April. And he is probably the last standing great intellectual of the left who's sort of still writing today. And now he's looking in this book at the complete full spectrum dominance of the US and what it means to have the world controlled by a single power. So that's fascinating, particularly when you think of it, this is a book that's coming at the point in history when US power appears to be on the wane and we're probably looking at a new country in the shape of China coming
up. Now, there's a very intriguing one, Richard, that you spotted, which is a biography of Osama bin Laden. And it seems to be by the former head of the CIA's Osama bin Laden unit. Can this be true?
Well, yes, as the US takes centre stage, one of the US's foremost foes is finally shown to be a figure of remarkable leadership skills. But it's intriguing to get a book from somebody who's been watching him for so long, who says he's a kind of strategic genius and has got amazing rhetorical abilities as well. It'd be fascinating to get a portrait of the man behind the caves, as it were.
So that's out from OUP, so very reputable publisher. It's by Michael Scheuer. I hope I'm pronouncing it right, and it's out in February. So now let's just move off politics. I feel tired already. Onto a really intriguing strand of books, which seem to be developing around landscapes, and they're the landscapes we have created and we are creating, or we will create. Sarah, you're interested in this, aren't you?
Yeah, this is right up my street, with no pun intended whatsoever. This is the stuff that I'm most looking forward to in the year, I think. Ian Sinclair is back in June with his new book, Ghost Milk, and the subtitle is Calling Time on the Grand Project. And it pretty much takes off where he left off in Hackney, that Rose Red Empire. Moving from the small scale to the grand scale, in this case, concentrating specifically on the 2012 Olympics and what it's doing to Hackney. And the fact that everything that, you know, the redevelopment side of it, the idea of regenerating this area, all that stuff was already there. And what the Olympics has done has basically rolled a steamroller across the lot of it, and it's hugely detrimental, in fact. But the one that I'm probably even more interested in is a book by poets Michael Simmons Roberts and Paul Farley called Edgelands, Journeys into England's True Wilderness. It's a sort of psychogeography publication. And
These are poems or prose?
No, it's prose, although prose. They are both. It's by two poets, and they teamed up because they're both interested in the fact that both of them, in their poetry, write about these sort of liminal spaces on the edge of cities.
They're so it's got chapters about canals, yes, bridges, masts, exactly. Landfill. Any book that has the line "container yards are places of beauty and mystery" has to have all our votes,
yeah,
doesn't it?
I think it's going to be brilliant. I can't wait to read it.
Richard, there are also a couple of speculative books, a couple in February, actually.
Yeah, there's a couple that are looking forward to alternative visions of what our future will be. The first is The New North by Lawrence Smith, which is due from Profile, a portrait of the world in 2050 as we migrate northwards as the world heats up, with northern rim countries like Canada, Scandinavia, Russian and the northern United States becoming economic powerhouses and magnets for migration.
And that's been praised by Jared Diamond of Guns, Germs and Steel fame, who is not to be sneezed at, so I think that will be definitely worth looking out for. But there's another one that takes a slightly different perspective.
Yeah, competing vision of the way we'll live next. Aerotropolis from Greg Lindsay and John Quesada, which is published by Alan Lane, which is predicting that we're going to live in cities which are a combination of giant airport, planned cities, shipping facilities and business hubs, a kind of network for the future.
That'll make Michael Simmons Roberts and Paul Farley happy, won't it, Sarah? lots more locations to write their next book at. Well, OK, well, now we're going to move into the domestic arena. Ben, you were quite smitten with the battle hymn of the Tiger Mother. What is that?
Well, I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but it certainly looks intriguing, and it also looks like it's going to cause an enormous amount of debate. It's a book by Amy Chua, who is an American woman, that she's basically talking about the difference between how Chinese mothers parent their children and how Western mothers parent their children, and saying there's a lot to be said for the way that the Chinese mothers do it. And they basically appear to have this, according to her, absolutely fearsome approach to achievement of their children, with precepts such as an A- is a bad grade, you must never compliment your children in public, the only activities your children should be permitted to do are those in which they can eventually win a medal, and that medal must be gold.
Oh my goodness. And I have to say that Ben is at this moment holding a proof copy, and her arms are very long. Does that body language signal a little bit of distaste in you?
Or just
long sight?
I'm absolutely fascinated to see what it says, but it just sounds horrendous, doesn't it?
Another book that I'm very intrigued by is Henry's Demons, and it's by Patrick Coburn, who's the famous Middle East journalist, and his son Henry, who has schizophrenia. And it's quite unusual in that they've written alternate chapters, I think. And Henry has been given the chance to describe what it's like to live inside a world where voices are telling you to do things and what that feels like. Which brings us to yet another strand. There's an awful lot about the brain and mental illness, Richard, isn't there?
Yes, absolutely. There's Simon Baron Cohen's got a new theory of human cruelty. It's called 0 degrees of empathy, which he talked about at the Hay Festival.
In particular, the thing I was really struck by was he had some evidence of brain scans of psychopaths in which when they showed a picture, I think it was of a pianist having a piano lid slammed down on her hands. In normal people, it lit up the sympathy centres, and in psychopaths, it lit up the pleasure centres, which I found particularly hideous. But anyway, what else?
There's also David Eagleman's Incognito, which is due from Canongate in April, arguing or explaining that consciousness is only a small part of the brain. An intriguing pair from Princeton, one from a philosophy professor, Patricia S. Churchland, due in April, called Brain Trust, arguing that our morality is written into our biology, stressing the role of the stress busting hormone oxytocin. So a philosopher very taken with neuroscience. And then on the other hand, a psychology professor, Michael Corballis, whose The Recursive Mind is due from Princeton again in June, who's arguing that the ability to put ourselves in our thoughts, the ability to embed ourselves in what we're thinking and think about ourselves from the outside is what makes us human. So that's a psychology professor very much taking a philosophical line in consciousness. Mm-hmm. Interesting to see which wins in that confrontation.
And of course, one of the things that makes us human and distinguishes us from the apes and from dandelions is the ability to write and speak poetry. So let us at this point reveal our mystery singing sonneteer.
You made crusty bread rolls filled with chunks of brie and minced garlic drizzled with olive oil and baked them until the brie was bubbly and we ate them lovingly, our legs coiled together under the table and salmon with dill and lemon and whole wheat couscous baked with garlic and ginger and a hill of green beans and carrots roasted with honey and tofu. It was beautiful, the candles, the linen, the silver, the snow falling quietly on our northern street. Me with my hand on your leg, you, my lover, in your jeans and green t-shirt and beautiful bare feet. How simple life is. We buy a fish, we are fed. We sit close to each other, we talk, and then we go to bed.
That was Supper by, and yes, you guessed it, the one and only Garrison Keillor. It's from 77 Love Sonnets, which is being published in book and audio form by Blood Axe in January. The poem is actually in Being Human as well, another Blood Axe book.
Yes, this is one, I think, probably in every New Year's podcast we've done for about the last 3 years, I've said. And this year, Being Human from Blood Axe, because they've been sort of pushing it back. And I've been excited about it for ages, because it's the third in their series of anthologies, which started with Staying Alive. And the second one was called Being Alive. And they're just these amazing anthologies. They show what the anthology form can do, uniting loads of contemporary poetry, including Garrison Keillor this time round. And I think it's just, you know, going to be absolutely exceptional. The last two have been really outstanding.
Staying Alive and Being Alive got a citation from Meryl Streep, I was rather amazed to see. How on earth did Neil Astley manage to go up and get a citation from Meryl Streep?
Honestly, truly, I think it's the power of these anthologies. They revolutionised poetry publishing in the UK. The books were bestsellers, and that doesn't happen for poetry. And it certainly doesn't happen for contemporary poetry, which these books are. It's just incredible. I think, you know, this is what's made Blood Axe the publisher that it is today, really, these anthologies.
Quite a lot of love around.
Yes, we also have in January coming up from Picador their anthology of love poems edited by John Stammers, which promises to be very sort of beautiful and elegant thing. He's a very good editor. And then in terms of individual collections, in January people will also probably be looking out for Night by David Harson, who I think...
Oh, I was judging the foreword. I gave him the foreword prize,
that's
everybody.
Right.
But he's rather gloomy.
He's a little gloomy. Well, then also moving on to other gloomy forward prize winners, this time one pick the year that I was judging the forward prize, is Sean O'Brien. In April, he's publishing a collection, interestingly called November. You might have thought that he could have waited a bit later in the year for that. But I think that he's just an outstanding figure in British poetry today, so I can't wait to see what he's coming up with. And then also another one that I'm really looking forward to is a translation of Pearl, the poem by the Garwayne poet on the death of his daughter. It's very, very beautiful, and this one's translated by Jane Draycott. A couple of years back, we had Simon Armitage's translation of Garwayne and the Green Knight, which did very well, so it'll be interesting to see if Jane can sort of live up to the standard that Armitage set.
Ben, you were quite keen on this, weren't you?
Love it. Studied all this at university and really
such
looking
a beautiful
forward to it. Yeah, absolutely.
As one who is permanently scarred by Anglo-Saxon at university, I think I this is very it. Good and important work that these rediscoverers are doing. Anyway, that's all for our New Year's podcast. Here's wishing you a very happy and fascinating New Year's reading from me, Claire Armistead, from Sarah Crown, Ben Page, Richard Lee, and from our producer, Tim Mabey. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.